Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Mormon News Report. Yes, we're still calling it the Mormon News Report at this point. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But first, before we get into all that fun stuff, including recapping the week in Mormon news, including doing some of our housekeeping stuff, we are joined by a very special guest. We are joined by Junior Bonner of the Bonner Family Clan, one of the best music groups out there. It's amazing and it's awesome. But Junior's actually coming on to talk about a very important project with Green Flake. So Junior, thank you for coming on to the Mormon News Report. Thank you for making time for us today.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I should take you everywhere I go. I mean, that was a great intro. Jeez.
Hey, you know, I hope the check's in the mail or something like that.
Done.
So John had actually gotten in touch with me and said, you've really got to get in touch with Junior Bonner and the stuff that he's doing with Green Flake. And I'd heard a little bit about some of the stories that happen with early Mormon Black pioneers. Obviously, with everything going on with Jane and Emma, we're hearing a lot about what Jane Manning James went through. And I hadn't heard that much about Green Flake until you and I had started texting back and forth. And
right.
How has this not been made a movie yet, Junior? Because his story is absolutely fascinating.
You know, I don't know, but at the same time, I do. Because literally, you know, I didn't know much about him earlier this year. You know, and so I just think people just don't know. Unless you're looking for it, it's not going to just drop in your lap.
So when we're talking about black early Black Mormons, obviously someone like Elijah Abel is one that comes to mind. We talked a little bit about Jane Manning James. Tell me a little bit, who was Green Flake and how does he fit into the larger Latter-day Saint narrative when it comes to our history and making it out to Utah?
Well, Green Flake is a unique character because different from Elijah and Jane, some of the ones that we just know about from just the little bits we hear, he comes from a background of being a slave. And that's not Elijah's background, Jane's background. But in addition to that, even though he came from such a rough beginning, he's the only one left that has actual family and descendants that are still in the church. Jane doesn't have any left. Elijah doesn't have any left, but he does. And I think a big part of that is because of his role in that pioneer trek.
So how was he converted then to the gospel and to the church? Because I've got to imagine if he was a slave at this time, I've got to imagine most slaves would probably not have missionaries on the plantation contacting them. So how did that all happen?
Well, a missionary made his way out to where Green Flake was, and Green Flake at the time was in Mississippi. But okay, for 4 years prior, 1840, he was inherited by his slave master, James Flake, and they made their transition into Mississippi from North Carolina. At that time, 4 years later, 1844, that was when a missionary then baptized the James Flake family, as well as a number of the slaves that were with him. And so that was when he had his conversion.
So, and I'm not sure if you would know this or not, but if, well, I guess two questions. One, would that have been common? And two, would a slave have had a choice in that, in being baptized into the church? Or would it just be the nicest way to phrase it, the owner or the master would say, okay, I'm joining this church now, and you all are going to do it no matter what?
Well, because the church it's still the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, you know, we want people to be converted by their own choice. And so, yes, they had that choice. Now, take that and then drop us back in 1840 and you tell your slave, it's your choice. We're doing this. So, yes, it's their choice. But I don't know of a situation where a slave did not. Mm.
Interesting. And so how did he go from Mississippi to Utah? Did he go immediately out to Utah, or were there a few stops in between?
Yeah, there's a few stops. So basically, around the age of 16. Now at 16, he's a young guy, but he was bigger than most men he had ever encountered. So he was a large man in stature. And so he was sent with a couple of mules to help some of the saints to make their way into Nauvoo. This is before Joseph Smith passed away and everything. So that's when he was sent out there. Joseph Smith died shortly after. And then from there, he stayed while the Flake family stayed. They slowly made their way to Nauvoo, and Green was sent on ahead with the advance group to make their way to Salt Lake.
So it really feels like, as I'm listening to this story and I've read more about his story, he really was, I don't know how to phrase it, but when we think of all the really foundational members who made the trek out west, who really laid the foundation for the church of what we have today. At least with him making the trek out there, with him being specifically called out by Brigham Young, as far as the work that he can do and the amazing efforts that he put forward in helping some of the pioneers, it seems really like he kind of was one of the foundational members that we don't have that many. I don't know how you describe it. We don't have the hero stories about him that we should, as compared to some of the others out there.
No, absolutely. You know, it's a touchy thing, you know, because to tell his story, you have to tell a lot more of the story surrounding it, you know. And that time in history is a sad time, you know. And so we have to look at it all. And he was a part of that slave narrative, that story that we've all heard about. And now we're attaching it to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. That's unheard of, but it's true. As a slave, he was signed over to the church, and under Brigham's direction, he was put in charge of leading that first wagon through.
So tell me a little bit about that, because that's one of those really uncomfortable parts of church history that a lot of us are still coming to grips with. The fact that he was still a slave when he made it out to Utah, so slavery was still there. And what was the relationship between he and the church, he and Brigham Young, he and everybody out there? Was he still viewed as a slave?
Yes. So he was. And it's difficult because there's not a lot that you can find. Literally, my history is, of course, talking with historians and then reading through journals of people who were a part of that trek, who encountered Green, his group, his vanguard group, finding his name in one of the journals and piecing together stories. Now, this is the thing. You know, while Joseph Smith was prophet, you know, in 1844, he was running for president on an anti-slavery platform. You know, so that wasn't the stance of the church. Joseph Smith, his stance was, if you get baptized to the church, free your slaves and join us. That's what Joseph Smith says. You know, he dies and things changed. You know, from what I can gather, it's just that there's been a lot of Southern converts that were coming to the church. So you have these Southern converts with this incredible workforce of slaves, and now they're in high positions in the church. And a lot changes, just the nature. Just the culture changes, you know.
And to go along with that, I think that you're even not only is what was happening at that time changing, but even the way that you and I are talking about this now, the fact that we are talking about someone and we are talking about a past in our history that would make a lot of people uncomfortable. You know, I think about everything that happened at the B1 event this last summer. I think you may have had, you know, some interaction with that or something like that, right?
Yeah. I think I photobombed something.
Yeah, something like that. But I think about that and how bluntly we talked about it. I think about – I was just watching the proceedings or following some people who were live tweeting the proceedings of a conference that was going on at the Maxwell Institute where they were talking about the church's history with race. And I think the fact that we're talking about it a lot more does so many things, because I think it helps us to capture a very complex history, but I think also it also allows us to find these really powerful characters that, frankly, have been hidden for such a long time. And I think of Jane Manning James. I think of Elijah Abel. I think of now Green Flake. So do you think that this is a blossoming field where we are going to see more and more of these stories that history has kind of looked over for a long time?
I think so. And it's not... these stories that will start emerging are not changing history. It's just adding to the history we know. You know, it's just we should know that Brigham Young chose Green Flake, a 17-year-old slave, to drive his wagon. Of all the men he could have chosen, he chose that man. There was something about Green Flake, and we should know more about him. Because when Brigham Young got sick, he sent Green Flake on to continue to lead the first wagon in to Salt Lake. My goodness. So the relationship between Green and Brigham Young, that is what really captured my attention. Because,
Keep going.
Well, I was just going to say, because Green was a slave. And although he was being serviced as tithing to the church by the Flake family, Brigham Young orchestrated his freedom when he really had no right.
So let's talk a little bit about that, because that's another one of those uncomfortable areas, the fact that a human would be used as currency even within the church and even in the tithing area. So it sounds like that was a way that some people could pay tithing. If you did own slaves, you could, in a sense, give them to the church or make them available to the church as part of that. Is that true?
Right. Their labor.
Mm. And it didn't. Was that common back then, or was it just the fact that there weren't that many individuals who moved out to Utah with their slaves that it would be even a possibility?
It wasn't common. It wasn't common. He was one of the few. You know, but like I said, he was an extraordinary man. He was, you know, so when he was sent out, and I mean, historians go back and forth on whether or not he served as Joseph Smith's bodyguard. Like, that's the type of man he is, you know. So when you have this man that's capable of possibly leading these people through an impossible journey, look, we'll take him. It's kind of, I think, the church's stance. And that's just what happened.
So you had mentioned Brigham Young, and yes. sometimes I tick some people off, because my stance has always been Brigham Young is an incredibly complicated individual. Brigham Young was someone who I personally don't believe the church survives unless you have someone like him at the helm. He really was an American Moses in leading that group of saints who had gone through so much, and you have to take that history into account. At the same time, he was, to put it lightly, he was cranky. He was a curmudgeon. He had some very strong views on things, and he was not always kind to African Americans. He had some very, very blunt views on that. But then you also see this relationship, and in some of the reading and research that I was doing before we talked, there really was a strong relationship between those two. And you had mentioned that when Brigham Young got sick, he said by name, I need Green Flake here, and Green Flake needs to drive my cart. So how does that make you feel when you understand, you know, the way that Brigham Young was and his views towards African Americans at that time, but also this really deep relationship that he and Green Flake had?
Well, you know, it's tough to even, you know, form an opinion on that time period. Because Brigham Young was faced with an impossible position. On one hand, you have a church that you need to make sure survives. That's his job, you know. And although he had his views on blacks and their level of celestial glory and all of those things, you know, at the same time, he was one of the ones that pushed legislation that helped slaves the most. When it became a slave state in Utah, which most people don't know, but in 1852, it became a slave state in 1852. But prior to that is when he freed his wife, Martha, and her family. Prior to that legislation coming through, it was a terrible time. And when it became a slave state, he made it to where slaves had certain rights and legalities that were not in other states. Now, I'm not making slavery okay, but I see Brigham Young between a rock and a hard place, and he made his choices. Now, as stiff-necked as we think he is, he's so just hard. What is with this guy? At the same time, the more I've read about him, he was an open man. He was open to the deliberations, the conversations, the back and forth. You have one of his good friends, Woolley Kimball. Bishop Woolley.
Yeah.
Bishop Woolley, you know, and he was a bishop for maybe 27 years, also a friend of Brigham Young. But Bishop Woolley was an advocate for equality and rights and everything. And they've had some arguments that are documented to where after their drag out argument, Brigham Young sitting here saying, hey, are you going to apostatize now or what's going on? You know, and Bishop Woolley say, no, you know, if it were your church, but it's the Lord's church. And then Brigham Young's over here saying, that's right, it's the Lord's church.
And if I could, I think that a big part of this whole thing, and again, I'm sure that we're going to have some people who are not as conciliatory towards the church sit here and say, you guys are just making excuses for Brigham Young. But I think the big point of this whole thing is just to sit there and understand the tapestry of the human experience, and to understand people are complex. People really are complex, and I think that that's where we have people like Green Flake, who their stories need to be out there because they add to that tapestry of the Mormon experience. So I've got to ask you one more question. So I know that there was some talk of a Kickstarter coming up, right? Can you tell me a little bit about what you're thinking about with this and when it's going to be available?
Okay, well, what's great about Green Flake, this movie that's coming, is that everyone I talk to is on board. Everybody wants to be a part of it. And like you said, I think people are ready to learn more and hear more. Like we're there. You and I are having this open, awesome conversation about it, you know? And so I've talked to, you know, a number of people. Brad Robbins from Gentry. He's like all in, you know? I've talked to David Osmond, Dallin Bayless, Alex Boye. You know, Alex Boye, are you kidding me, man? Are you kidding me? You know, he's all about it. You know, everybody I've spoken to wants to be a part of the project and is a part of it. Now, so those people I've spoken to are going to be a part of this Kickstarter. What I'm looking to do is put together a concert. The Bonner family is going to be a part of this presentation that's going to go towards a bunch of the social media influencers and kind of do like a showcase concert, talk about Green Flake and present what's going on. And we're going to blast it all at the same time. The people who are going to be involved in the film, some of these celebrities that I just mentioned, and everybody who has a social following, you guys, anybody who has a follower on Instagram is going to be blasting it all at the same time. Less than a month.
Cool. So less than a month, we'll have more information and keep me in the loop because we will definitely make sure that we're highlighting that on our show because it's an important project. Do you have a few more minutes to stick around with us? Because we're going to talk about something that you've also been involved with, the Jane and Emma movie.
Oh, I'd love to.
Cool. So, Jenny, I'm going to bring you back on here. Obviously, we've got some connections to Jane and Emma. We've been pushing it really, really hard. Junior, can you tell me a little bit how you were involved with Jane and Emma and what's your connection to the film?
Yes. So I am the composer for the music for the film. So that's the original songs you hear as well as the underscore. Myself and my partner, Jonathan Keith, did the score. And then I did the songs that you hear in it with my family, the Bonner family.
Jenny, I've got to say, hearing the music in the film really also sets a huge mood because if you think about all the complexities that are going on and really the complexity of emotion, I don't think you don't have it captured if you don't have the music that Junior and all of them were involved with. Would you agree?
Every now and then you'll see a film where the soundtrack is its own character, and this is absolutely the case, and it's a vital character because of what it brings to what's already established in the film and adds that much more.
And I'll say this. So Jenny, when I'm thinking of movies that the soundtrack almost becomes a character, right? Obviously I've seen this movie on Clean Flicks, but the movie Baby Driver is one of those where the music is and the sound is such a part of that movie that if you take it out, it's almost something completely different. And
it's
I think
vital.
And this one does the same thing. So here's what we've got to talk about. So opening weekend was this past weekend. I want to, Jenny, what's the disclosure that we need to do? Because you've been helping out with the film, right?
The disclosure is that I was hired to help with the marketing angle of Jane and Emma.
So there's our disclosure for everyone. And obviously Junior helped out with the music. So,
yeah.
But what I want to do is I want to be as objective as possible. So I grabbed a few reviews. So this is from the Deseret News. With the highly anticipated film Jane and Emma set for release Friday, movie tickets purchased on opening day will be matched up to $40,000 with a donation to the NAACP. According to a press release, $25,000 will come from the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints Foundation, and the other $15,000 will come from the Bonneville Charitable Foundation. The NAACP applauds the producers of the film Jane and Emma for working to bring light to a figure in Latter-day Saint history. Janetta Williams, president of the NAACP Salt Lake branch, said in a press release, the donation will help further the NAACP's mission to ensure the political, educational, social, and economic equality of rights of all persons to eliminate race-based discrimination. And Jenny, I think the donation has already been made, right? We're good there.
Yes. I don't know the accuracy of that breakdown as far as $25,000 and $15,000. But yes, it was up to $40,000, and opening night last Friday, October 12th, $40,000 was exceeded. So bravo, everyone. And just for clarity's sake, the donation went to the NAACP Salt Lake branch.
Which is such an amazing thing. So reviews really quickly. This is from Liesl Neeson of KSL. While I appreciated what this film was attempting to do with such difficult and controversial topics, I also found myself at the end wishing the film had just been about Jane's life, which, Junior, this is something you and I were talking about, right? Like, people want to hear more about Jane. They want to hear more about Green. Jane's friendship with Emma was unique for its time, but it's not the most interesting thing about Jane, who has become somewhat of an icon. So that was KSL. The Salt Lake Tribune, Holly Richardson, said six members of our family went to see Jane and Emma at the Salt Lake City premiere on Wednesday night. It was powerful and beautiful and sparked some good and painful conversations. As I asked my ninth grade daughter, adopted from Ethiopia, what she thought of the scenes that showed some of the racism and shared some of Tamu of Sisters in Zion and also another contributor to the film, some of Tamu's experiences, she said, "That's happened to me. What has happened to you?" I asked. "Being called the N-word. Damn it, that is so not okay. The conversations being sparked by Jane and Emma need to happen, and that includes the role of strong women." And Jenny, you had a chance to talk with Holly, didn't you?
Yeah, she sent me a text the other day as she was we just kind of had a few back and forth just talking about this. And Holly, I don't know if you guys know Holly Richardson. She's an amazing woman. She has 25 children.
Really?
Let me say that again. Whoa. No, let me say it again. She has 25 children. She has one of the strongest and at the same time softest hearts when it comes to giving and understanding and wanting to relate to other people, their experience, their pain and their growth, and just extend love. And we had many great conversations as in regards to this film. And I'm so grateful that she shared that experience that her sweet daughter had, because, you know, the conclusion is absolutely correct that this film sparks conversations that are necessary for us.
Absolutely. So the Salt Lake Tribune, Sean Means is a fairly, I wouldn't say he's a rough reviewer, but he is an aggressive reviewer and he doesn't hold back on his words. He gave it 3 stars and said, Larson, our old pal, Melissa Leilani Larson, roots the story in as much historical record as available. And where that's lacking, she fills in with a thoughtful imagining based on her impression of Jane and Emma's personalities. The result is a portrait of an abiding friendship with each woman respecting the other's plight. Emma, as a new widow, forced to share her grief with Smith's followers, and Jane, as an African-American woman, weary of proving her faith in Smith's gospel, is as strong as that of her white neighbors. So, Junior, now that we've gone through a few of these reviews, and now that we've had the opening weekend done, now that you can look back in the rear view, what are some of your thoughts and feelings based on some of the reception that Jane and Emma has had so far with the opening weekend?
You know, I'm just happy that people are going to see it, like stepping out of their box and just going to watch it. Start there, like just getting out of your comfort zone and go see the movie. You know, that's my first thing. And the second thing is, with this movie, it's tricky because there's two women. For one, there's women leading the film, you know, so that's one thing. The second thing is both of them in a time where we don't really talk about Emma. We don't talk about Jane. So, yes, we could spend the whole movie diving into Emma. We could spend the whole movie diving into Jane. But what we got to see is the relationship between these two women during a terrible time in history find love in a bond. And literally, it's paralleling our world today. You know, what the media tells us our world is going through racially is terrible. But here we are, all of us finding bonds between races in our individual lives. So it's mirroring today. And I love it about that film.
And I'll go a step further and say the fact that Melissa chose this one snapshot in time, you know, the 24 hours after the death of Joseph Smith and showed not only how it affected people, but the complexity of emotion that happened with that too. I mean, that's where I really think, and I don't want to be speaking for different people, but that's where I think for a lot of white Mormons, we could take a step back and say, wow, there's a lot that I just didn't know. But also for black Mormons, I know that a lot of what Tamu has said, a lot of black Mormons who have seen this movie is they just feel so thankful that this story is being told and that in a sense they can say, yes, that's it. I've experienced that. And I think that especially having an all women cast, especially having as diverse of a supporting cast as they've had, it really does help. And if anything, it gives people the chance to, like you said, have the conversations and hopefully start binding everything. 'Cause that to me is the most important. So
absolutely.
So, Junior, I don't want to keep you too long. I know we've kept you a couple minutes after. Really quickly, when we get information on the Kickstarter, you'll send that over to me and we'll plug it on the show. If anyone wants to follow you, are you on any social media or anything like that where people can know more about you and know some of the fun activities that you've got going on?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you so much for that. GreenFlakeMovie.com. That's where they can keep up with what's going on with the film, when the Kickstarter is going to happen. GreenFlakeMovie.com. And then you also have my Instagram, probably the best way, MauliB, MauliB. And that keeps you up to speed with what I'm doing, working on the music and on the film.
Cool. Thank you so much for coming on. And remember, greenflake.com or greenflakemovie.com?
Greenflakemovie.
Greenflakemovie.com. Cool. Junior, thank you so much for coming on. We appreciate it. And definitely keep me in the loop.
Great. Thanks so much.
All right. Talk to you later. Thanks, bud.
Yep.
Okay. Bye. Okay, so Jenny, you had mentioned that our old pal Connor Hilton had actually given a really great review. I'm looking at it on Twitter right now. He wrote, "Jane and Emma 2018, stunning, incredible performances and a beautiful score and songs. One of the best faith films I've ever seen. A powerful and resonant story of women and faith and doubt and friendship and race and wow, 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 wow. Essential viewing for all Mormons, loads to ponder and sit with."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's perfect and beautiful. And I will say this, Jenny, we've been pushing so hard with an independent film like this. It is so important to have a solid opening weekend, not just because of the obviously the financial impact, but what it does is it opens a lot of avenues for additional distribution, video on demand, whether we're talking negotiations with Netflix or Amazon or anything like that. If you have a big opening weekend, it makes those negotiations a lot easier. We don't have numbers yet. I've been furiously refreshing Box Office Mojo to see the numbers, and we don't have them yet. Do we know anything? Like, does it look like it was a solid opening weekend?
It does. So right now from PR Newswire, and again, this might be different tomorrow because we have to take into account Sunday, right? But the weekend box office report is 122,000 on 21 screens.
Whoa.
With an average of 5809 per screen average. So that's still, I mean, Sunday isn't over yet and we don't know, but like you were talking about with the wider distribution, we can share a link that is where you can kind of, you know, demand a screening. So, if you know, you want one in your area, cause that's one thing that I hear a lot about, you know, people want to know, well, I'm in Cincinnati. I want to see it. How come I can't see it in San Francisco?
Jenny, I'm in Detroit. I want to see it.
Yeah.
What do we got to do to get it out here?
Yeah, let me, I'll find that link about demanding. We'll put that with this episode.
Cool. So again, everyone, thank you so much for supporting this movie. It's great. It's really good. And the reason why I wanted to pull those reviews, Jenny, was because they're from quite a few different places, both from fairly conservative organizations, but also fairly liberal organizations, whether it be culturally, socially, or even religiously. And the message that's coming home is this film is good. And I like what Connor said, because you, after the film, you just kind of sit there and you sit with it and you think about it. And I think that's the sign of a great film, is to sit back and go, wow, what did I experience? Personally, I think that the portrayal of Emma Smith was phenomenal. I think that she, some people said that her acting was a little stiff. I actually found it extremely appropriate for the time, in a sense where she's a woman who's trying to keep herself together, not only through the tumult that happens, but also through the trauma that just happened the night before, and having to be a strong woman while she's breaking on the inside. I thought she was great. I thought that Jane, just tough as nails, and some of the conversations that she had with Emma were great. And I think it passes the Bechdel test, because we're talking about two women who are talking about something really deep and not just, oh, I want a man to like me, or I'm in competition with you on another man. So,
right, okay. Exactly. And for just a little bit of context for people who might not know, both Emily Goss and Danielle Deadweiler, the actresses who play Emma Smith and Jane Manning, they're not LDS. So as actresses, they've been talking about how they read the script and they approached the roles from essentially just humanity's sake. They don't have the background and the history of the stories that we do. And I'm not even talking really about Jane, but about Emma. You know, there are some people who are like, well, that didn't seem like Emma. Well, that's because there's a different thing going on. So definitely worth checking out. So thanks for all the support.
Yes. And it's been wonderful to see that. Okay. Jenny, let's do a little bit of housekeeping. We're going to do a pre-show meeting on air, recorded for everyone. The name of the show, we call it the Mormon News Report. I like the phrase, the Mormon News Report. Should we think about changing the name? I know that we kind of toss this back and forth. If I were to ask you right now, do we keep it or do we change it? Where do you sit?
I sit with, we probably change it eventually, but it's got to be the right change. But for now, I say we keep it.
That's kind of where I'm leaning to. I say we keep it for a few reasons. You and I have both gotten the messages and the emails of people thinking that we're the actual Mormon newsroom, like the official news. I don't know. Listen, we're not as polished and professional as them, and we don't say the things that they would say. And if we change our name to something like the Latter-day Saint News Report, I think there's going to be even more confusion. Whereas at least if we keep Mormon, it's kind of the signifier of, okay, we're not really official. Plus, and someone made this comment to me, and I actually think it's very appropriate. We don't just cover what happens within the Latter-day Saint Church. We cover everything, and not just the official happenings within the Latter-day Saint Church, so what you would find on Mormon Newsroom, but we're going to talk a little bit about Proposition 2. We're going to talk about some Utah culture. We talk Utah politics. We talk Mormon politics. There's all kinds of stuff, and so I think it applies, although in my personal vernacular, I'm trying to use the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or the church or something a little bit more. So,
likewise. And I want to take a second just to remind everybody, because I really think Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I think that is getting a little stale, especially when it comes in the form of like correcting people and comments. And I would just say, if you go back and read or listen to President Nelson's talk about the name of the church, he included in there, you know, an invitation to be patient with people about that. It's not an easy thing. Some people will maybe not understand, or, you know, it's just be patient, just be kind. Come on, guys.
So basically my joke is done now.
Well, no, I'm not talking about you saying that.
Oh.
I mean, because we all, you know, understand that. Like John gave a presentation yesterday, you know, and in talking about what he does for work at the company where he works, he ended up saying the name of the church a lot, and I joked with him that he could have shaved 10 minutes off his time if he would have just said Mormon church. But
here's the thing. I almost called you Ashley. Whoa, that is uncomfortable. Jenny, here's the thing. Every high schooler who has to hit a word count right now for papers in high school should be taking notes to say, hey, this is how you do it. Write papers about the church. But make sure that you're including the full name, because you're going to hit that word count within the first 20 minutes, and you just got to fill in the rest. So
that's true. Yeah. And just to be clear, I think what I'm talking about is more along the lines of just like when it's a joke and it's like, oh, you know, we can all laugh at it. That's one thing. But when you are legitimately like suggesting to people, probably even more so if you don't know them, that what their aim is to give Satan a victory. Come on, man.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. And we're gonna talk a little bit more. Surprisingly enough, the President Nelson's remarks at the women's session and at the Saturday afternoon session, or maybe it was the Sunday morning session, whenever he talked about the name of the church and his remarks at the women's session on Saturday night, received the most buzz this week. So we're going to talk about those. The other thing that I want to hit on, and I want to make sure we spend a few minutes talking about it, I ran out of time because we were trying really hard to keep it to an hour last time. I mentioned that we're going to be separating from the cultural hall at the beginning of the year. And I just want to make sure that we clear the air and that there's no questions and no funny business at all. Richie and I have been talking about this. And Jenny, you and I have been talking about this with him as well for a long time. What we found is that with our release schedule and his release schedule, we're actually covering a lot of the same news stories. And while we have different perspectives on it, the thing that we didn't want was for people to sit there and go, well, why would I listen to the Mormon News Report if I just listened to the Cultural Hall and they talked about all the same things? Why would I do this if they're doing that? And so we've decided, hey, the podcast has gotten a lot bigger than what we thought it was going to be, which is awesome. Thank you very much. And now it's time for us to, mommy is saying, hey, let's take a step out of the nest and see if we can fly. And that's what we want to do. I will tell everyone this, and I want this on the record, and that's why we're recording this and I'm saying this. Richie was the one who birthed the Mormon News Report. I was in a Facebook group and I would post links to a bunch of the stories that I would find throughout the day. He liked it so much, he said, why don't you come on my website and do that? That's where the daily email started. I did that for about 3 years. And then we transitioned over to the podcast, and he gave us space on his site and let us use his distribution network to get the podcast out there. We don't have the Mormon News Report if it's not for Richie Stedman. So Richie does deserve a lot of credit for helping this off the air. And I have no ill feelings. I consider Richie a good friend. He and I still text each other a ton. We still talk about a lot of these Mormon things that we're going to be talking about here. It just, Jenny, it just made sense for us to say there's way too much duplication, and let's take a step. So that's what we're doing.
And I want to have complete clarity that Richie and I are now mortal enemies.
Oh.
Now, we're in a huge fight all the time. No, we're not. And I know that, you know, a lot of times people who maybe know us personally will hear this and they'll, you know, no, you can tell me what's going on. What happened? What happened? Where was the fallout? No fallout.
Nope.
Look, we want each other's success here on our different programs. And just like the spirit of the Cultural Hall, just like the spirit of Mormon News Report, there's enough room for everyone. So you can only you can only, you know, get better by encouraging each other's success. So
a rising tide lifts all boats, right?
Yes. Yes. So what that means from a practical standpoint is wherever you happen to subscribe to this Mormon News Report podcast, if you're getting it on the Cultural Hall feed, then soon it will no longer be available. So it's probably to your benefit, if you want to keep listening, to go to the Mormon News Report and subscribe there.
Yep. So whatever pod fetching app you use, if you use Apple Podcasts, if you use Pocket Cast, if you use Downcast, there's a bunch of them other out there. All you have to do is go into the search section and type in Mormon News Report. You'll be able to find our feed and you'll be able to subscribe from there. And once January 1st, 2018 hits, the Cultural Hall feed is, or 2019, I'm sorry, 2019 hits, the Cultural Hall feed is turning off. So if you want more of the Mormon News Report, go over to the Mormon News Report podcast feed. Okay. That was serious. That was heavy.
Yep.
We're good, right?
Yep.
Okay. So a couple of things that we missed last week or the last couple of weeks.
Oh, wait. Sorry. You just said that as of that day, the Cultural Hall feed is turning off. Not for them.
Not for them. For us. I'm sorry. For us. You will not find the Mormon News Report on the Cultural Hall feed. They're still going to be doing articles of news. They're still going to be doing their all the interviews that Richie does. You just, we just won't be there. Right. We got our own
thing. Although I do have to say, because some people will ask, Jenny, will you still be on articles of news? Yeah. Sure.
Well, listen, Jenny, in pure Mormon polygamous fashion, I mean, I guess we're good with that.
Did you just zing me?
Don't know. I'm just sitting here in my awkward uncomfortableness saying, wow, Brant, that probably wasn't the best joke to make.
No. All right. But yeah, so we're all,
anyways,
just, so everyone know that there's no bad blood. We're all still best friends.
Yep. We're all BFFs. Okay. So let's do Pod Talk Radio. Big news happened over General Conference or the week before General Conference. The LDS Church and the Utah Medical Association and a bunch of people, basically everyone involved with Pod Talk in Utah, reached a tentative compromise over the Utah medical marijuana policy. This happened on October 2nd. The initiative's provision allows people who live within 100 miles or more from a dispensary to grow their plants. That's gone now. So that was one of the things that was carved out in the original Proposition 2 language. Mm-hmm. The agreement has also tightened up the current Proposition 2 provision permitting a person to use a defense to criminal charges for possession of marijuana on the basis that they can demonstrate they would have been eligible for a medical cannabis card despite not having one. Basically, if my reading of this is if you were charged before, you really couldn't have it. Although they were saying, well, but if you would have gotten it, it's welcome to lawyering 101. Until under the agreement recently reached over the medical marijuana policy is going to be in medicine format rather than the Wild West format you will see in the initiative. There's going to be a hybrid dispensing model, I can tell you that, one that incorporates many of the ideas of the legislators and our initiative's dispensary model. A hybrid in this case would be some of the state on having a centralized fill-in pharmacy. That's about the extent that I can get into. So we found a little bit more information. Basically, what they're talking about is having centralized state-run dispensaries. So instead of just private dispensaries popping up and you take a doctor's recommendation over there, they're going to coordinate it all through the state. And Jenny, I believe that's similar to some of the state-run liquor shops.
I was
going to
say,
right?
It's just like the state liquor stores. Like they're not open on Sundays. They're not open on holidays, that sort of thing.
There's some extreme provisions that go in place because it is state-run and they can do that kind of stuff. But it's also there. Under the compromise, and this is from the Salt Lake Tribune, under the compromise, the Department of Health would also issue up to 5 licenses for privately owned cannabis pharmacies, a number that could increase to 10 if the state-run system fails to get off the ground. Although these private facilities would follow many of the state regulations that apply, they would dispense only medical cannabis. So they would. One of the things that they had also talked about was it's only going to be medical cannabis. They're not going to be doing, I believe they described it as things that could be alluring to kids, like brownies, gummies, things like that. What you are going to see, the election's going to be in November. Utah Governor Gary Herbert called for a special session of the Utah legislature following the election in November to discuss a new shared vision for the medical cannabis policy. So, Jenny, what I'm reading and what I'm seeing here is they made a compromise. And I like compromises. I don't like one side saying, you're going to do it my way, come hell or high water, you're going to do it my way. I like both sides coming together and understanding each side of what they're going to do. It'll be interesting to see what this special session does, especially in light of how Proposition 2 does. I think my gut feeling is they made the compromise because they know Prop 2 is going to pass. I don't know if I want to go to the extent of Kurt Frankum and you know, bet me eating a shoe. By the way, Kurt, we haven't forgotten. You still got to eat a shoe. So, but I think what they're signaling here is we think it's going to pass. So therefore, let's get ready for it. We'll have the special session right after so we can start working out the language of this compromise.
Yeah, if anything, I like that that instead of just the announcement of the special session, it's, okay, so here's the provision we're taking out, the thing about the six plants that you can grow if you live more than 100 miles from a dispensary, that sort of thing. Like, the specifics are already there. They're already kind of on the table.
Mm-hmm. Which is what our old pal Sam Brunson said when he first looked at the language and said, there's a lot of wiggle room and gray area here, and this is not as airtight as we think. Therefore, that's my big concern with it. I like the fact that they're saying, okay, let's start clamping down a little bit and saying, yes, this is specifically what we mean. I actually read a piece, I didn't include it in here. I read a piece that said that, like the anti-discrimination and LGBT compromise that happened a couple years ago, people are looking at the Utah compromise saying, maybe this is a way when it comes to medicinal marijuana that we can start moving forward. So you might see a lot of people watching Utah to say, how's this going to affect? The other thing that stands out, Jenny, is if this does go forward, what's going to happen when it comes to Mormons and marijuana and medicinal marijuana? Are we going to see the church get even stronger in their language of saying, no, we're not going to do it? Or are we going to see them saying, yes, we're going to let people do what they want? I think that's the big story that I'm following, watching this whole thing, is who knows? We could see some interesting stuff happening.
Yeah, I just hope that having this special session doesn't just throw everything out the window. Yep. So.
Nope, I'm with you. Okay, folks, we are going to be right back after this commercial.
Signature Books is proud to announce the release of Salt Lake School of the Prophets, 1867 to 1883, edited by Devery S. Anderson. The school, with nearly 1,000 members at its peak, was a decision-making body that nominated candidates for political office, discussed theological issues, and tried to manage life in Utah after the completion of the railroad, when an influx of non-Mormons to the territory ended the isolationism that saints had known and cherished. The minutes shed valuable light on pioneer Utah and the Mormons. Signature Books has published award-winning scholarly books in Mormon studies since its founding in 1981.
Thank you, Jenny. Let's hit that outro. Awesome. Okay, let's get into the big three stories, shall we? So the ones that I saw that were really making a lot of headline were three of them. One, using the word Mormon. Well, maybe not the big three. Maybe. Okay, there were. Using the word Mormon, President Oaks' comments, and then the social media fast. So let's hit on the Mormon one really quickly. Surprisingly, I know you and I had talked about this, and I liked what you said about let's have some patience, because for so long that was just a natural part of who we were, and especially with the push that we put on Mormon.org, I'm a Mormon. We actually, in my stake, in my mission, do I'm a Mormon firesides, where we have people who have converted, and we have them do a fireside. The missionaries all go to it. They bring potential people who are learning about the church, and it's always a great environment. I don't necessarily like it, because when it happens at my ward building, we're not allowed to be in the building. So with a bunch of young men in the middle of the winter, what are you going to do with them? There's not much. So that's neither here nor there. But my bishop actually got up this Sunday and said, oh, I guess we're going to have to change that. So it's going to be interesting to see where we go with it. But Dr. David Scott, a professor in communication, talked with Fox 13, and he said the blogosphere erupted since Nelson explained his reasoning. Scott says church history shows the term Mormon is actually neutral and not meant to be disrespectful. Joseph Smith actually said the word Mormon in reference to the Book of Mormon prophet, that the term Mormon means more good. And I believe President Hinckley said that too, didn't he?
Yeah, he said, yes, like in 1991,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, because I remember that was one of the – I wonder if that was one of – that really was one of his crowning achievements, was the mainstreamism of Mormonism, because mm-hmm. he really did take a lot of those steps. So Scott also said the term Mormonism has been used over 15,000 times in general conference talks as far as we have record. So it is going to be tough for us to move along from it. Polygamists and others are actually kind of happy that they can embrace the term and we're getting away from it. This is what Nate Carlisle at the Salt Lake Tribune said. David Patrick, mission president for Christ's Church, also known as The Branch, and has temples in Utah and Nevada, sees the name in its historical context. The LDS Church created divisions, Patrick said, among those calling themselves Mormons when it issued two manifestos abandoning polygamy and disavowing what's called the Adam God theory, a belief still held by Mormon fundamentalists, saying that Adam of the Garden of Eden fame is also God, and that Heavenly Father and the Heavenly Father of the human race. I think that I would like to think that we consider ourselves Orthodox Mormons, Patrick said. Mind you, this is a polygamist offshoot. Mm-hmm. And we're staying with the original tenets of the faith, and that hasn't changed, and it's not likely to change, where the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints would like to evolve to a different way of being than the foundation that was laid by Joseph Smith Jr. So, Jenny, that's really not surprising considering their views on us in the modern mainstream LDS church, but I think that that's an unintended consequence that we didn't think of, that a lot of these offshoots are going to say, hey, if you're not going to use Mormon, I'll take it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I really like the blog Get Religion. It is a blog that talks about reporters and religion and how the press reports on religion. Richard Osler, who is actually the writer of a book, Mormon America, which was one of the big – it came out in like the mid-90s. It was one of the big mainstream books looking at Mormonism in a somewhat objective fashion. He talked a little bit about the name change, and he said, "Yet journalists should consider the pleas of Nelson and his predecessors because it's good policy to follow religious groups' preferences when feasible. A conservative Protestant group may ask the media to avoid ultra or fundamentalist labels as inaccurate or invidious. Yet centuries ago, the Friends embraced the Quaker nickname, though scoffers originated from it. The church policy statement wants media to use the full TCOJCOLDS, he actually used the acronyms, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, in the first reference. That's what the AP recommends in articles covering that this one faith. However, that isn't feasible in headlines or when broadcasting that needs quick identifiers and isn't sensible if this group gets only brief incidental mention in a story," end quote. So, Jenny, the thing that stands out to me, and this will be the interesting thing to monitor, is this going to be something where President Nelson said it, he said his piece in General Conference, and we're going to move on? Or is this going to be continually reemphasized from an institutional basis? Or number two, are we going to be looking at this almost as Mormons policing other Mormons or wanting to look at the media who don't follow the church's style guide and say, ah, oh, see, they're not respecting us? So that's what I don't...
Yeah. So far, what I see online is the Mormons policing other Mormons, along with Mormons saying, oh, that says Mormon, fake news.
You actually seen that where people say, oh, that's fake news?
Yes.
Because
it's ridiculous. Just because they use the word Mormon. What I have seen actually, and I wonder if this might be a trend, is kind of like at the beginning, like when you read an article and it has a big name and then in parentheses, it'll give the acronym. Mm. So if it says like toward the beginning, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and then in parentheses, Mormon Church. So they've identified it properly, but then for the rest of the article for the space of word count or whatever it is, they use Mormon Church. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think that it'll be interesting to monitor how that goes on. I think probably one of the more interesting ones would be to look at like the Deseret News or KSL. So a company that is owned by Bonneville, which is owned by the church, and to say, okay, how do they follow it? Are they starting to find, I don't want to call it shortcuts, but loopholes?
I look at it as just ways to be more succinct.
Maybe that's a better way of saying it. I don't think they're doing it maliciously. I think what they're trying to do is say, how can we, you are, whether you're dealing with TV and radio where you have specific time cues, or you're talking about print media where you have a specific word count, when you're adding in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that's 9 words compared to Mormon Church, LDS Church. It makes a big difference, and that'll be interesting. And maybe that's what's going to happen is people will take their cues from them. I don't know. I'm with you, though, and I think, look, let's be cool. Just be cool. Be cool. Be patient. Maybe, I don't know, Jenny, this might be crazy. All right? This might be crazy. Maybe we actually read President Nelson's talk and say, oh, he said we actually should carve out charity as people begin to make this transition. It's a correction that's going on, and corrections. Listen, I've described the church as a big battleship cruiser. You don't change church culture on a dime. You change it like you would a big battleship cruiser, where it takes a long time for it to go perpendicular to where it's going. It's going to take some time.
Yeah, agreed.
So, okay, let's talk a little bit about President Oak's comments. President Oak's comments. So, Jenny, the text was made available for General Conference this last week. I've actually gone through and started reading some of it. The one that actually really impressed me the most was going through and rereading President Nelson's comments in the very beginning, describing the 2-hour block, and then Elder Cook's comments, because it showed that there was, I don't know about you, but there was a lot that was packed into those first two addresses at General Conference that I just didn't get a lot out of, because it was like, mm-hmm. I was still thinking, holy crap, two-hour church. I saw someone on Twitter say, the problem with three-hour church now is you're driving this old, beat-up piece of junk car, but you know a new one's coming in like 2 months. And it's like, oh, every Sunday is going to be difficult because you know the 2 hours are coming. It's, you got relief coming. So anyways, mm-hmm. So the one that I haven't gone back to yet were Elder Oaks comments and Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune, someone who has pulled no punches when it's come to the LDS Church, talked a little bit about President Oaks comments and said the hard part of Oaks' speech was that families like this one, a family that he was profiling that had someone who was transgender, who accept and embrace and love one another, are painted as sinners, while those who fight and shun and try to change people are righteous. Think of the opportunity that the gospel, as I understand it, could be used to include them and relieve them of all the suffering in the world throws on this community, the father said. I see such a missed opportunity of being able to be at the forefront to really apply honest-to-goodness Christian principles. And instead, they're saying, if you even support this, you're part of Satan's plan. And I say, my gosh, how wrong could you possibly be? End quote. Jenny, I've had quite a few people get in touch with me this past week, and you probably had some similar conversations with some of your friends, that mm-hmm. the President Oaks address really bothered them. And on the one hand, I think you're going to find a lot of people who appreciate someone like Oaks really getting old school and hardliner. Because I think there's quite a few members of the church who they want to know exactly where the line is to make sure that they're opposite that line. At the same time, it's just such a contrast when you compare, and we've talked about this ad nauseum, when you compare the sensitivity and the emotion and I guess sensitivity is the best way to describe it, that was happening in the Sunday sessions versus those Saturday sessions with Oaks being very hardliner. It really seemed like night and day. And there's part of me that says it's the yin and the yang and the balance of all things. But on the other hand, it's like, but do we really need to go to that extreme? Like, really?
Yeah, it's hard when we hear talks that kind of seem like almost like there are people out there who are still, you know, looking for a reason or a justification for their hatred or their discrimination, whether or not they recognize it as such. And then they hear something like this that can be that essentially they feel like gives them license to be anything other than loving. Mm. Now, listen, I wanted to say too that I know people who I respect and love very much who quite, you know, appreciated President Oaks' talks. And I haven't had a chance to talk with them in detail about that. Not that I need to, you know, be like, what are you talking about? But, you know, I feel like, you know, for my own standpoint and my own weaknesses, I get defensive of people in certain categories or groups. And so, you know, just like other people might be looking to, you know, have justification to behave a certain way, you know, I need to look at myself and maybe I'm looking for a way to be like, no, don't, we need to be more inclusive, but who's to say again? And to be honest, I haven't reread that talk. I've been rereading, listening to Elder Anderson's talk Wounded over and over again. So I actually am going to be teaching Relief Society on that next week. So,
ooh, anyway, fancy. Yeah. But how much of a shill would I be, Jenny, if I said, can we implant a little microphone on you and have you record that? And then just like, we'll just put it out for the podcast this last week.
That's a really good idea. So, but anyway.
You know, I got a couple of friends at Mormon Lease. They might be able to hook us up with a few people who can.
Yikes.
I'm with you. I think that I don't know. If I just try and be objective about the whole thing, this is President Oaks. President Oaks has taken up the mantle of being the hardliner, of being the big heavy, if you will. He's the way that Boyd K. Packer was, the way that Marky Peterson was, the way that Bruce R. McConkie was. He has taken up that mantle. And so on the one hand, it's almost like you kind of have a trigger warning when you know that he's going to be speaking. On the other hand, I wish it was I wish it was a little softer. I wish it was a little more caring and understanding. But I don't know. Maybe Jenny, maybe there's a reason that he's in the first presidency of the LDS Church or the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Sorry about that. I fixed myself and I tried not to call it out, but I did call it out. So I'm sorry about that. And I'm just a doofus here in Detroit. Let's talk about the social media fast, because I know that you have very, very passionate thoughts on this. The Washington Post surprisingly did a really in-depth look at President Nelson's remarks to the women and specifically the social media fast. And one thing that they had talked about, and Jenny, I know that well, maybe I should just let you talk about it. The social media fast when it came to the premiere of Jane and Emma was something that was weighing a lot on your mind, right?
Yes, because as a marketing team, we all kind of panicked a little bit. I know I did. And we kind of had to get creative to reach those who we knew were not on social media. That being said, we also knew that you have to take other things into account. For instance, that people may be on and looking on social media, but not posting, or they may be fasting and, in a different way. And I'm sure we'll get to this because all this commentary here, but just right out of the gate, I'm just going to say, it was a recommendation. It wasn't a commandment that he do it, though many would say, well, the prophet said to do it, so you do it. And
also didn't have to do it right then, right?
Exactly. There was no starting date. It didn't say that. But to be honest, two things that I'm really uncomfortable with. One is kind of what it's hard to express how frustrating it is to be kind of publicly told, to be instructed to do the social media fast without the men being included. And listen, he asked the youth to do this earlier this summer, maybe in March or March in April with the priesthood session. Maybe he'll ask the men to do it. I don't know.
Can I tell you something really interesting about that? So we had Bishop's Youth Council today, and we were talking a little bit about it. I gave the spiritual thought, and I was kind of going over some of the things that President Nelson had talked about at the women's session. And one of the laurels. So usually the way that it is the young women sit on one side of the bishop's office, the young men sit on the other side. It's just because we're dealing with teenagers, right? This is what they do.
Sure.
There's not a lot of intermingling when it comes to teenagers. But one of the laurel president, looked at our side, pointed her finger, and said, "What's up with you guys? Why don't you guys have to do a social media fast?" And it was kind of said in jest, but I think there was a lot of it yeah, what about you guys? And so look, I would hope that I built up enough credit in the bank with everyone to so that people would say that they knew this was a joke. But I said, well, maybe the dudes aren't on social media as much as you all. To which the young woman president scoffed, laughed, looked at me, said, "Yeah, right, Brant." And then said, "What's a podcast, by the way?" And I was like, "Well, that's not really social media." And she's like, "No. Don't you can't wiggle your way out of this one." But that the fact that Laurel, it stood out to her that the men haven't done it yet, or the teenage boys haven't done it yet. And they're, listen, Jenny, you're around kids. They're all of them are on Instagram, every single one of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Snapchat. And the thing is, I mean, that's kind of my frustration, is that it was like a public call out. And the thing is, I agree with Charlie Mullins Glenn from MWEG, which we'll get to in a second, that the timing is unfortunate. The thing is, I feel like I already take a break when I need to, because moderation in all things. Already when my kids are getting too aggressive or too, they're not participating in our family, then they take a break. I insist upon it and they don't like it, but it's important to do when something could be like that. It's important, but this kind of bleeds into my second point that I had a really hard time with, which is just that we were asked to do so within a structure that wasn't private, as if the suggestion that I can't be trusted myself to take a break when I need to, or know that, or when I need to, but also that what I saw a lot on social was this, these public posting, I follow the prophet, see you in 10, # whatever. And the thing is, with regular fasting, we're told not to, announce it oh, I'm fasting, I'm just so starving, and blah, blah, blah. That's if this is a fast, then this is a fast. And so, and I mean, I've also heard horror stories of people who have been criticized by family members, friends, you know, which anyway, but yeah, so that's kind of thing, like being called on it as if I don't know when to take a break on my own, but also, you know, and that it's implied that there, that it needed to be immediately and within this certain structure or fashion, but also that's a private thing. You don't go around to people, you know, on Fast Sunday and chide them for not fasting because you don't know. Right. So anyway, those are my thoughts.
I'm with you. And it's interesting. The folks over at This Week in Mormons did a very interesting blog post where they went through and they looked at a lot of influencers or people on social media and kind of them doing that, you know, these very public, I'm doing this. Now, in defense of some of them, part of it was the fact that it's tied up in their business. And there was actually a story, I'm not sure if we've got it in here, but of someone who, it might have been in this Washington Post story, of someone who ran an Etsy shop. And mm-hmm. So on Mondays, that was when she posted all of her new stuff. And she said something like 70 or 80% of her orders came in on Mondays. And because she's doing this, she only had one order come in on Monday because she didn't put any new stock out there. So Jenny, the interesting thing about this is I think that it leads to some interesting things. I know that this is something that Ashley's been trying to do. Mm-hmm. But she, one thing that she brought up was she said, Fran, I'm a stay at home mom. We live in a neighborhood where there's not a lot of other moms here, in the sense of with young kids like ours who are at home all day. Most of them are either older or out working. And I don't get much interaction. And so, yeah, this is my only interaction. And so she said, I'm trying. I'm only giving myself certain times during the day, which, by the way, no one's telling you how to fast. You could fast however you want. And that's something that you talked about, Jenny. But I think the fact that it's something that weighed a lot on Ashley's mind to sit there and say, I'm trying, but it's hard, but I don't exactly know why. I understand why, but also there's a lot of these other things that need to be brought up. So one of the things, and you had talked about it, was Charlie Mullins Glenn of Mormon Women for Ethical Government. And one of the things that the Washington Post and a couple of other stories had talked about was we're now on the home stretch for the elections happening in November. And an unintended consequence of this was the fact that this might have some reverberating effects, especially for some women, some faithful Mormon women who are running for political office, now maybe not even being able to use it. So what she told the Washington Post was she thinks that Nelson did not intend to interrupt the campaign season. Quote, I see absolutely no insidious ulterior motives in President Nelson's invitation to women of the church to participate in a 10-day fast from social media. I agree that the timing is unfortunate and could look suspicious to those predisposed to cynicism, but the truth is that these general conference talks are prepared weeks and sometimes months in advance. And so this really was in response to a few rumors that were out there about, well, we I don't know if we had a chance to cover the story, but there is a lawsuit pending in which a daughter of, it's the daughter of President Nelson, isn't it?
Yes, one of his daughters and her husband.
Is alleging that there was some sexual abuse that went on, and some people out there are.
I think it's that they're not the ones alleging. The allegation is that they are the ones who did it.
They're the ones who did it. Okay. See, and I haven't followed the story as closely as I should have. So thank you for the correction. But there are some people that are saying, oh, this is just to silence that. There are some people that are saying that the recent leaks from Mormon Leaks describing some of the abuse claims that are going on in the Curtin and McConkie, the law firm of the church, it's to silence that. There are some people that are saying it's to silence some of the stuff that's going on with Fast and Testimony Meeting. I don't buy it. I'm with Charlie. It just seems like the timing was unfortunate. A church spokesman said he would let Nelson's speeches speak for themselves and did not respond to questions about why Nelson's call to get off social media was directed only to women. Although Kathleen Flake, who is an amazing woman that everyone who's interested in Mormon studies should follow, says she does not think Nelson meant to rebuke the Me Too movement or to subdue women's political activism. She pointed to signs that the church has supported women's concerns about sexual harassment, including an unusually strongly worded editorial in the church-owned Deseret newspaper that called upon Donald Trump to drop out of the 2016 presidential election because of the Access Hollywood video. Quote, I don't think this is telling Mormon women not to be political on sexual virtue. I think that would be the last thing you would hear from these guys, Flake said. I don't think he's talking about politics. I don't think he's talking about sex. I think he's talking about focus. Recalibrate your priorities, know what matters, and just detox. So it's interesting to see the context of that. And Jenny, I'm kind of with Professor Flake. I think that that's really what he was striving for. It would not surprise me at all if he were to go to the priesthood session and say, guys, it's your turn now. Although I will say, and I don't, Jenny, I don't have demographics on this. Maybe it's something, if I get bored this week at work, it's something that I could look into. But to see the users of social media as compared to men versus women, and if President Nelson comes out and says, hey, by the way, guys, I know that you're not using social media as much as women have, because we have these statistics here. So I'm asking you to give up football on Sundays. And if that happens, you want to talk about a sacrifice, Jenny. It's going to be a sacrifice for me to do something like that. Mm-hmm. But
the other thing that's been frustrating is just the misunderstanding of what social media is. FaceTime is communication. It's not like, that's not social media. Like, technology does not equal social media.
But isn't that the thing, though? It's vague enough that you should be able to apply it however you want to apply it. You know,
exactly.
And I don't want to get all lawyerific on some of the way that we use language in the church. But as we've talked about with someone like Nylund McBain, who's looked at the church handbook and said, there is a lot of personal interpretation that happens with a lot of these things. And so who's to say that a social media fast for you isn't a social media fast for somebody else? It's up to you. And I think the piousness that we see with some people where it's like, oh, well, we've decided to stop doing FaceTime with our kids because that's social media. I'm sitting here going, are you kidding me? Are you understanding what's going on there? Now, if you're using FaceTime all the time and interrupting everyone's lives, yeah, maybe you should take a step back. But that's why I like what Professor Flake said. It is about recalibration and focus and detox. And so, yeah, it would not. So the joke that came out in Bishop's Youth Council as well was this same Laurel said, guys, you watch it. This isn't just 10 days. The next thing he's going to do is he's going to get up and say, okay, you did 10 days. You did a week earlier. You did 10 days now. Let's do a year.
Wow.
I don't know. I was like, oof, that'll be interesting.
Well, that goes to the next. I mean, that's the reason I'm worried, is because the next story from The Guardian, that Mormon women, you know, who use social media for their jobs, like I do, to manage their families, or, you know, the political campaigns. But also, I mean, social media legit is connection for people. Like you're talking about, you know, like maybe Ashley feels like if you live far away from family, if you live far away from friends, or you just feel alone and social is how you've connected, then that's a difficult thing to tread. But like you said, like look at what that could mean. There's room for interpretation, and I would even say pray about it. Right?
Yep.
Pray about how you should do this.
Yep. I'm with you. So The Guardian, it was again, more people in more women in politics who have Facebook ads running where you're looking for views. And if there's a lot of women that you're targeting who are not on Facebook during the social media fast, yeah, it might have an impact. The last story is from Slate. They talked with Jenna Reese and they talked a little bit about this. And they also talked with Michelle Quist, who is running for city council in Salt Lake County, Utah. And she said, I don't know why my prophet felt this was a good time for women in the church to step back. I know our national dialogue has been caustic, but there's still a national conversation going on. If we're not in it, then we can't influence the conversations for good. She also talked with the columnist also talked with Jenna Reese, who said the social media fast took everybody by surprise. I'm not in a position where I can simply give up on social media for 10 days without any warning. She said she plans to observe the fast at a later time, perhaps over the Christmas holiday, which, hey, do what you want, dude. Like, now she did say this. What irks me about it personally is that men have not been invited to do this yet. To be fair, Nelson suggested a week-long social media fast earlier this year for young people ages 12 to 18. And it's possible that a similar call for men will come in the future. But another speaker this weekend urged women specifically to limit their reliance on cell phones, which was President Oaks. Asking only women and children to abstain so far, Reese said, quote, sends the message that teenagers and women may be using the internet for frivolous reasons. In her column on Monday, she noted that only one woman addressed the full audience last weekend compared with 26 talks delivered by the men. So, Jenny, I feel... I shouldn't feel this way. I feel a little silly spending this much time talking about the social media fast because it was like people are going to do it or they're not going to do it. But I think when it comes from President Nelson in an environment like General Conference, people take it a lot more seriously. And on the one hand, I like what Jenna said, where she said, look, I'm going to do it over the Christmas holiday. And it's, I could see some people saying, oh, you're just doing it when it's convenient. at the end of the day, I don't care who does what, who does when. It doesn't matter. Like, shouldn't we need to keep our own house in order. Maybe we need to go back to the old Mormon creed of Mormons, mind your business, because, yeah, and all others will do the same, because that's what we need to do a lot better at. Instead of looking over on while you're taking a social media fast, quote unquote, taking a social media fast, going on to Instagram, but not liking anything and saying, oh, well, it looks like Ashley's still on Instagram. Well, that tells me what I need to know about Ashley. Come on. Who cares? Mm-hmm. Who cares?
Yep. It's such a private and personal thing. And it, you know, that argument that I hear that, you know, like, oh, you're not following the prophet. You know, you're like, it's an accusation, right? You're just doing what works for you. Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm following. I mean, it's like, I couldn't fast when I was pregnant.
Yep.
Does, you know, where's the accusation there? So anyway,
yeah. No, I'm with you. And I think that, if anything, what is doing is people in their eagerness to follow President Nelson and the things that he says, in their eagerness, have sometimes taken it to an extreme. And sometimes we Mormons, we do that. And it's mm-hmm. we need to be better at that. But at the end of the day, no, I don't know. Jenny, should we take a bet? Do you think that at priesthood session, the men are going to get a similar challenge from President Nelson?
I don't think I can bet on that. I just have to cross my fingers.
Cross it, well.
Because the thing is, if it doesn't happen,
that'll be a big talking point. It really will, yep. especially considering some of the ways that people have said that the women's session felt to them. And Jenny, I know a few friends who have gotten in touch with me saying I really like the women's session. There's a disconnect in the sense of, you know, how you and Jenny felt. They really liked it, and I don't know. It's a very interesting time, and I try to be egalitarian about it and say, hey, I'm interested in the conversations. If you're someone who it really upset you, let's talk about it. If you're someone who really liked it, let's talk about it, because I want to know. I don't know. I'm just a guy who talks a lot. I really don't have that much to say. I don't have that much substance. I just talk a lot. So okay, So Jenny, should we do Sunshine in Your Soul? I've got something. Do you want me to go first?
Yeah, go ahead.
So I. We set a low bar sometimes for youth speakers in the church, probably because we're dealing with a bunch of teenagers who they've got their talk in front of them and they're reading it like this. And then Joseph Smith said, and the definition of baptism, according to LDS.org, is name of Jesus Christ, amen. Like, that's what they do, right? Mm-hmm. But it always amazes me when you get a kid who gets up there and just hits a home run. And we had that happen in my ward today. And, you know, look, my sacrament meetings are my attention is divided 15 ways because my, you know, I've got one kid trying to force feed me goldfish. I've got another one who's upset because she can't find the pink crayon because she wants to color. And then I've got the same kid who's feeding me goldfish is now crawling under the seat. So my attention is divided 15 million ways. But Ashley and I were listening to this talk or trying to listen to it. And it was amazing. This kid, he's 14 or 15 years old. He told personal stories that affected him. He tied it in with the gospel and said, these are some stories from my life, and this is how the topic of today was friendship, and this is how friendship relates into it, and this is how I view friendship in the context of the gospel, and that's it. And he sat down, and we both turned to each other, and it was like, that was really good. And so, yeah, the bar's low for 14-year-olds, but I think we would have said the same thing if it was someone older. And I think the thing that I liked the most about it was you could tell that he spent some – this was not him – listen, he might have done it last night at like 11:59 p.m. or something like that. And his dad might have – you know, his parents might have had some input, but you could really tell that he really thought a lot about this. And I thought it was impressive. And Jenny, it gives me hope. I don't like it when people say, oh, kids these days and all these millennials and stuff like that. I hear all that stuff at work all the time. And I'm sure, especially with what you do with social media, you're around a younger generation. There are some very frustrating things that go along with it. But one of the reasons why I've loved serving in a youth calling has been there are so many times when you just look at this rising generation and go, holy crap, you guys are going to be so much better than we were. You know, mm-hmm. I'm thinking of a lot of things right now. You know, the fact that when you're talking about someone who's gay, growing up, you describe them as the F word all the time. Like, that was just part of our vernacular. If you didn't like something, you called it gay. And that does not even enter into these kids' mind now. It's almost like a really dirty word for them to say, which is just, it's great. Like, we're getting better. They're around so much more diverse people. And so it's, I look at this kid and how he just got up there and hit a home run with this talk. And I think back on some of the youth that I serve with in my young men's organization. And Jenny, it gives me a lot of hope for the future. It makes me very happy.
Awesome. That's great to hear.
Okay. What do you got?
Just thinking about families and prioritizing families and how families look different. I mean, it's really easy to say, you know, like, oh, no family looks the same. Every family looks different. But like when you're living it, the reality of that is that it isn't always easy to live in that situation. And, I'm just grateful, today that my son turned 12 on Wednesday.
I'm glad you brought it up because that's what I was going to say is we got to talk about that.
Yeah. He turned 12. And, so today after church, he received the priesthood, the Aaronic priesthood. He was ordained to the office of deacon.
Is that what he called it?
No, it is not. He said that he was going to get the Aaronic priesthood.
Ha ha ha.
Because he's a funny boy.
He is a very funny boy.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it was just, you know, for myself and for my husband and our son, who lives with us, to drive an hour. And I mean, you know, I get it. Like an hour, well, it could be so worse. Yeah. But I'm saying like,
it's a sacrifice, right?
Yeah. We also had to drive that far. You know, we drive that far several times a week, you know, to go down there for basically 10 minutes, but that we were invited, that we were welcomed, that the bishop, you know, down in Utah County knows that I am my kid's mom, that John is my kid's stepdad, you know, shakes our hands, remembers us like he has in common with John that they love the Cougars. Right. And so go Cougars is their thing. And so, it was just, you know, I was just sitting in that room and my son, you know, was sitting in the chair and his dad's hands were on his head along with the bishop and John's hands. And then we took a picture of, you know, of our family in the weird shape that it is. And it isn't even a complete full family picture. It's just, that's what we've got. And I'm a strong believer that when you prioritize your family, the easier those, inevitable challenges will be when you face them.
You know, the cool part about families, they come in all different shapes and sizes, and we all have the same struggles. And you know, some family members get frustrated with each other and all this stuff like that. But at the end of the day, we're all family. That's the best part about it. So, okay, folks. So thank you very much for bearing with us. We've put together a lot of stuff over the last little bit. Again, if you want to keep getting the Mormon News Report in your podcast feed, make sure you switch over to the Mormon News Report podcast feed. We're going to hit on this a lot. Like I said, we're not going anywhere until January 1st of 2019. So you still got a little bit of time. To everyone who has Facebook messaged and emailed us, thank you very much. I'm in the process of working through them and responding. So thank you for sending those in. I frankly, Jenny, I've been forwarding you a lot of the correspondence that we've received. I've actually loved hearing specifically from the women and their thoughts on the women's session of General Conference. And I think it makes the tapestry of Mormonism that much more, I don't know, cool to see, hey, we can all experience different things.
Yeah, I agree. And in fact, since this week we talked with Junior, do we have time next week to kind of address some of those emails? I don't remember the schedule.
Yes. Yeah, okay. I think next week, I don't remember who we have coming on. We're going to have a bunch of guest hosts coming on and stuff like that.
Is it but next week? Well, we'll figure it out.
Figure it out. Anyways, so yes, thank you everyone who's been emailing us in. If you would like, we would always appreciate a review on iTunes or a 5-star rating. You could do that. If you want to follow Jenny, you could follow her on Twitter at @formerlyfred, @formerlyphread. You could follow me at The Mormon News. We're on Facebook. We're not on Instagram because I don't do the picture thing. I'm not very good with the pictures. I have an Instagram, Jenny. I have a personal one, and I think I posted like 4 pictures because I don't do pictures. Anyways, so thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and we will talk to you again after a while.